You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When and if the rapture comes, any number of things might happen. The chosen believers who've been waiting a long time for this moment may be caught up and sucked into the air to meet Jesus, or he may descend upon the world in a fiery wrath, anointing his elect and leaving the unchosen to figure it all out. Well, maybe. In Tom Perrotta's new very funny novel, The Leftovers, a rapture-like event occurs, but without a fiery Jesus and with no answers for those left behind. On October 14th, people from all walks of life, good and bad, and not just Christians, simply disappear. The book is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Perrotta back to our show.
Hello. Oh, it's great to be here.
And congratulations. The reviews have been spectacular.
Oh, thanks.
Can you tell us more about what happens on October 14th?
Yeah, so this event is, I use the phrase a rapture-like event because it's a random rapture, which is kind of an oxymoron. And what it does is create a crisis, a theological crisis for Christians who are left behind and feel like this can't be what we were waiting for, and opens a space for a lot of different religious reactions that people have.
Well, if they feel like they would have been chosen, and then they look at the people who were, I'm going to quote, depending on your viewing habits, you could listen to experts debating, this is later, the validity of conflicting religious and scientific explanations for what was either a miracle or a tragedy, or watch an endless series of gauzy montages celebrating the lives of departed celebrities, John Mellencamp and Jennifer Lopez, Shaq and Adam Sandler, Miss Texas and Greta Van Susteren, Vladimir Putin, and the Pope. Do they all disappear at the same moment?
That's how I envision it. The big difference between the sudden departure, as they call it in this book, and the popular images of Christian raptures in the Left Behind books, people shed their clothes. And so there's this sort of ghostly reminder of who they were. But in mine, there's just a kind of Star Trek-like disappearance. Just poof, they're gone.
And are there any clues to where they've disappeared to?
There are none. And you know, I know that there are some readers who will be expecting maybe that the mystery will get cleared up at the end. But for me, the whole point of the book is it's about the human condition of not knowing. Mm-hmm. You know, we always live with this sort of cosmic uncertainty. You know, religion is an antidote to that if you're a believer. But for people like me, we just don't know, and we have to keep going anyway.
Is that what you started with, the idea of dealing with the matter of not knowing, or did you begin with the concept of a variant of the rapture in mind?
I started thinking about the rapture in a kind of what-if way, and the key for me was this idea of the tribulation, the seven-year period after the rapture where the world is full of plagues and wars and the rise of the Antichrist, and the people left behind are, given a second chance to kind of get on the right side. And what I was thinking was, you know, 7 years is an awfully long time in our culture. And I thought, you know, maybe 3-4 years in, would people even remember the rapture, or would it be just another event that had happened the way that, you know, terrible wars and genocides and disasters are now?
Well, like 9/11, which for 364 days of the year is something that we don't think much about until we have the anniversary, or in this case, a 10th anniversary.
That's right. And I think that the book became for me about the way cultures remember and move on at the same time.
Did you research the history of the rapture in Christian thought?
I had read a lot about Christianity and contemporary Christian theology while researching my last book, The Abstinence Teacher. And I read a great book by Norman Cohn called Pursuit of the Millennium, which was about all sorts of medieval cults where people would decide that they were the second coming of Jesus and create, you know, all kinds of political instability as a result.
Well, the first predictions for the end of the world were, I think, the year 1000.
Yeah, somebody's going to get it right someday.
Were you pleased when Harold Camping predicted the rapture last May?
Well,
you'd probably completed the book by then.
I had, but I was actually grateful to Mr. Camping, because one of the things you deal with when you write about something like the rapture is that for some people, it's a hugely important concept, and for lots of other people, it's almost unfamiliar. So I would sometimes describe my book to people and especially to, you know, to if I have friends who are scientists, I'd get this blank look. They hadn't heard of it, or if they had, it had just been written off as a kind of, you know, crazy superstition. And I no longer have to explain it. The media explained it for me during the camping fiasco.
Well, I guess your friends don't look at the bestseller list because the Left Behind books have been perennially popular. How long?
I know. It's amazing the number that they've sold. But I do think there are really two Americas when it comes to matters of religion. And it actually happened for me where I was, you would talk about camping and most people I knew would find it amusing. But it so happened that somebody I went to high school with, you know, was one of camping's followers, sold his business, and a lot of other friends were, you know, talking to him on Facebook, trying to say, you know, don't do this, don't follow a false prophet, that's numerology. And I was just so aware of, you know, two entirely different streams of thought.
Well, camping has predicted the rapture twice based on all sorts of mathematical work that he's done. But how did you come up with October 14th? Is it just a day you pulled out of the hat?
It was actually the day I started writing the book. So I thought I would memorialize.
So is this a rapturous experience for you? But this is not about religion. Although there are people who come up with new variants on religion as a result of it.
Yeah, no, it is about religion in the sense that I think the roots of religion are in, you know, incomprehensible events and our need to make sense of them or find consolation in the wake of them.
And you've set the story, your story, in the town of Mapleton. Is this a town that you've been in the past?
No, but it's right next door to some other fictional towns that I've written about. In fact, I mentioned the town the abstinence teacher takes place. It is one of the neighboring towns. It's just a suburb in an unnamed northeastern state. And the main character, Kevin, is the mayor. And I'm using this community as a kind of microcosm to think about the different impulses that we have in the wake of a terrible event.
Well, you have always written about the suburbs, haven't you?
Yeah, not because I have any agenda toward the suburbs, but because I grew up in a small suburban town. And except for a few years when I lived in Brooklyn, now I live in a suburban town again. It's just where my life has taken place. It's the world that I know, and it's where my imagination sort of automatically goes.
But aren't there different kinds of suburbs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I grew up in a very working-class suburb, and some of my early books are, you know, very much about that specific world. And the last few books have been about, more prosperous suburbs.
Tom Perrotta's latest novel is called The Leftovers, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. And all of the survivors in Mapleton are white suburbanites. Were you making a point there?
No. I think again, I'm just if this book were set in a city, I think the population would be a lot more diverse. And this particular suburb that I'm writing about is mostly white, though there are some characters who are not.
Well, the novel mainly focuses on the Garveys, Kevin Garvey, mm-hmm. you mentioned. What were they like before October 14th?
Well, I think they were a pretty happy, prosperous family. Kevin was a businessman who owned a family chain of liquor marts. Big sort of suburban supermarkets for liquor. He has just sold the business. His son Tom is going to Syracuse University. His daughter Jill is a very good student. Lori is a busy stay-at-home mom.
But she disappears.
She reacts very badly to this rapture-like event. Her best friend's daughter disappears, and Lori spends a lot of time grieving mm-hmm. with her best friend. And her best friend goes and joins one of the cults in town called the Guilty Remnant. And Lori tries to go back to her real life and realizes that she's no longer suited for it. It doesn't seem right. And she eventually joins this cult called the Guilty Remnant.
But it also opens up possibilities for some and closes down possibilities for others.
That's right.
Kevin, for example, now is free to pursue all of the fantasies he had when he was a married man.
That's right. Though he's having trouble with impotency as while this is going on, which is he's finally single and looking for love, but he's also a little bit traumatized.
Are you writing about how people use times of crisis to explore new possibilities?
Well, that certainly is one of the things that happens. You know, their son Tom goes to college and is haunted by the disappearance of a kid that he knew in elementary school and he hasn't seen for some years. And as a result of this pain he's in, he sort of drops out of school, finds his way into a cult devoted to a man named Holy Wayne, who thinks that he can heal people and has a plan actually to be the father of a savior. And Tom ends up on this odd quest to spirit Holy Wayne's child bride across the country. And he has a kind of a heroic story that he kind of wanders into.
Do you think that readers will compare the rapture-like event you write about to something like the financial crisis of 2008 or 9/11?
It's hard to say what readers.
I mean,
do
you want them to?
I was thinking about the financial crisis of 2008 only in the sense that it was the first time where I suddenly thought, "Wow, the future could be dramatically different from the way that it is now." I always just sort of assumed that we lived in a kind of stable world, and that, you know, 20 years from now would look pretty much like right now, except maybe we'd have better technology. But all of a sudden, I thought, "Oh, I better learn how to grow food." You know, I better think about what it would be like. You know, if the banks collapse, if you know, the trains stop running. You know, I just had this moment where I felt like the ground got a little shaky, and it, you know, it came and it went pretty quickly. But I remember that moment, and I felt like a lot of people feel that way now. Like they don't really know what the future is going to be like, and the people in Mapleton. You know, that's really vivid. Something about this event and its incomprehensibility has left them really uncertain about their futures, and that makes their present, as you say, it's up for grabs in good and bad ways as a result.
Well, this book is probably best described as a tragicomedy. But you always write funny. Is that something that just comes naturally while you're writing?
Well, it's actually an interesting point because my original thought was, oh, I'm going to write a comic novel about the apocalypse. Because I thought, well, that hasn't been done before. You know, obviously it's a grim subject matter. But in choosing this particular mechanism for the apocalypse, this rapture-like event, I discovered that all of my characters were really in a state of grieving and bewilderment. And so I found that the book was less funny in the end than what I had originally hoped, but there were odd opportunities for humor throughout.
Although some of your characters, if not genuinely happy, at least are optimistic enough to want to go on living, which in The Leftovers is kind of a big deal.
I think if there's a sort of central insight in the book, it's that no matter what horrible thing happens, some people just, you know, they're intent on living their lives and they feel like they have to go on. And, you know, I think there are really two conflicting impulses in the book. One is to remember and to say, you know, our lives will never be the same. And the other is to say, all right, it happened, you know.
Where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? So people are looking back and people are looking forward at the same time. And that seems to me to be how we move on. We sort of glance over our shoulder while we move forward.
Hasn't The Leftovers been picked up by HBO for a potential series?
It has. So potential is the key word. So I'm going to write a pilot script.
But in other words, you would go beyond the novel. You wouldn't just do an adaptation of the novel.
Right.
Life would be going on and on as long as they kept on picking up the option.
Right. So my sense was maybe the first season or two we could stick to mostly what's in the book, but eventually you would move beyond what's there. And this is what I love about long-form TV right now. You can really live with characters for a long time.
You can also come up with a lot of explosions, which are perfect for movies, right?
That's right.
Tom Parada's latest novel called The Leftovers is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.